Speaker for the evening, so please give a warm welcome to Sharon from San Diego.
Hi, my name is Sharon. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for having me be here. It's a pleasure to and a privilege to be able to speak to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. You mentioned the phones. I answer phones twice a month for two other meetings. And it seems a particularly special thing to be able to do. It's completely anonymous, of course, but you might be the first person that somebody speaks to from Alcoholics Anonymous, and to be able to direct them to a meeting or direct them to the right person. I'm going to start breathing sometime soon. It's very special. I had a fellow a week ago who started off the conversation with, "Got the bus this morning." Good. He said, "Do you know how much it costs to go to cook school?" "Well, no, I don't." He said, "Do you think I can go to a woman's meeting?" I said, "No, I don't think you can." I said, "Have you ever been to a meeting?" He goes, "Yeah, I go every day." All right, then. I was born in Pennsylvania. I'm one of six children. I'm the fourth, so I still sometimes am going, "Look at me!" It's hard to get over those childhood things. It was hard to get through adolescence, too. It took me about 25 years. But details. My home was a kind of nightmare for a kid. My father was alcoholic. My mother, everybody was dealing with an undiagnosed illness. And the world and our home revolved around that. It was violent. It was frightening. You always wanted to be a moving target instead of a sitting duck. There was sexual abuse, physical abuse. Five kids under the age of 10 all screaming while Dad's beating us in the basement with boards and belts. It was scary. And even when it wasn't terrifying, it was really weird. We used to have to jump off the second story roof into my father's arms, purportedly, in case there was a fire, so we'd be able to escape. As a kid, I knew this was totally insane. No, let me stay in the house and burn in the fire, I knew that there was nobody else on our block that was doing that. You know, it's like, why do we have to do that? Anyway, that was one lighthearted moment I remember. But, yeah, you know, when I came home from school one time and we did that thing where you fall back, you know, and it's a trust exercise. You fall back and somebody catches you. I had been caught all day long by these 10th grade boys. And I went home and I told my dad the whole thing. "And then you fall back and I'm going to fall back." And he let me fall. Like, wow, this isn't getting better. The time he set my hair on fire was really bad, too. And that's what kind of household it was. And so the first moment that I could get out of there, I ran as fast as I could. And ran away from home, only to find I had no equipment whatsoever as to how to live in the world. So I sheepishly went back and, got some things together before I ran away again. And I was a girl that grew up in Pennsylvania, as I said, and somebody told me they were moving to Martha's Vineyard. And I said, "Count me in." It was the dead of winter, and I thought it would be kind of more romantic and cool if you went in the winter instead of everybody goes in the summer, you know, like that's so boring. So being on an island in the middle of the Atlantic in the winter is really cold. And I remember walking one time in really blizzard conditions, going to I don't know if there were state stores there. They were in Pennsylvania. And I was getting a bottle of Matus, which would tell you how long back it was. And I had one of those moments, frozen moments in time, when this thought descended, like, do you drink alone? I thought, yeah, and I just kept going. Evidently, somewhere in my past, I had seen the 20 questions, and some of them resonated, and that did that day. Not that I took heed of the warning, but once I was able to look back years later, I saw that there were those moments over time. I worked in a bar in Martha's Vineyard. The drinking age was 18, so evidently I impressed the manager. And at the end of the workday, he would pull a bottle off the bar and give it to me and say, you know, here, you can have that. I went home and drank it like it was a homework assignment and absolutely despised the flavor of most of them, things like B&B and Courvoisier and stuff that would make me really ill today. But, you know, 18 years old, I went home and slugged it down and went back the next day and said, well, this is how it was, and this is what I did. And should have been a clue, but it wasn't. I left there one day, like I left my house tonight, you know, books in the bookcase and clothes in the closet, and a woman had said she was moving out to Colorado for the season, and would I like to go along? And, yep, I was going out there for 6 weeks. I made it. I came back after 9 months and wondered where all my clothing was. But, you know, leaving Pennsylvania, I didn't know it at the time, but I just kept leaning into anywhere I could go, anywhere I could get away, anywhere that was different, anywhere I felt different. So I just kind of kept going. And from Colorado, I hitchhiked all through the Midwest with my iron worker boyfriend, and that was an interesting experience. You know, these things that I did, like, I'm not going to be doing again. So I'm glad to have had these kind of unique experiences. From there, you know, each space was like a mark along the belt of drinking, adding drugs, doing more things, drinking more. I had a blackout on Highway 25 going from Boulder to Denver. And the last thing sounds like I'm making it up, but it's not. The last thing I remember was one of the highway signs that says, drinking and driving don't mix. And I woke up or came to in Denver and didn't know how I got there. You know, again, it was like a clue. Gee, this is serious. I then, you need a map. Then I went to upstate New York and lived in a meditation center for 2 years. And it was a very settled atmosphere. We didn't eat garlic or onions because they unduly excite the nervous system. And, you know, we meditated every day. And I was there, as I said, for 2 years, and to the day I left there, somebody I knew was going to some party in Connecticut, and I snorted cocaine for 3 days straight and drank around the clock. And you know, can't get here from there, but it was as easy to me as, you know, falling off the log. I met a fellow there who said something extravagant like, you're special. I knew right then he got me. And so we were engaged a short time later. I had no business being engaged to him. And I had to make my amends well into sobriety because I wasn't sure what I was making amends for, but eventually it was understanding that I couldn't reciprocate his love. He was loving with a true and a real heart, and I was incapable at that time. I just was thinking it was really fun, and we were having parties, and, you know, his aunts were coming from out of state, and they were serious about it, and I was having fun. So I got very sick. Oh, I didn't tell you this part. Then I went to West Africa and spent several months there, and the long and short is that, well, in terms of drinking, you know, the first thing I found, the place that I was at did not have running water and no electricity and so on. So the first time they brought out booze, it was warm. How rude. And, you know, it was a big, gigantic bottles of, you know, some sort of Japanese beer. And it was warm, and I said, oh, no thanks. And, you know, guess how long that lasted? All of a sudden, I loved really warm beer. And the stuff that's a licorice drink, that was, like, totally disgusting. I grew to love that, too. You know, when people say sometimes, like, oh, you know, it wasn't my drug of choice. I think, who cares whether it was your drug of choice? If it's on the table or, you know, in the glass, let's drink. So I got sick when I was in West Africa, and that's the circumstance under which I found myself coming to California. My mother had just moved from Pennsylvania to California. So I came here, and I still haven't taken a deep breath, but I came here, and I had hepatitis, and I was yellow, and I was going to the hospital each week and giving blood to see whatever my blood levels were. And, you know, the doctor said, you can't drink. And if you're like me, you don't hear you can't drink. I heard if you kind of really kind of want to, and sometimes you can, then you should not drink. And it took a long time to get better. But during the time that I was starting to get better, I was at the end of my drinking run. I kept trying to live in a normal way. The 2 years in the meditation center meant that I was seeking a healthy way to live, a quiet way to live, a real way to live, something that seemed important, something that seemed like it wasn't worthless, something nonviolent, something maybe with meaning. And, you know, when you drop acid in the morning and smoke for the rest of the day, it doesn't get real meaningful. You know, it does, but you forget about it the next day. But, so, you know, I don't know. People are sometimes a little touchy about drugs. I'll tell you that I'm grateful that they accelerated my bottom. If it weren't for drugs, I could have been out there for another 20 years of misery. And they just really shortened the trip because they brought me down to my knees. I finally called Alcoholics Anonymous and asked them, and I haven't described with any fullness like what brought me to that level. The fact was that I couldn't live with myself any longer. I couldn't continue doing the wrong things that I was doing, not getting to work, you know, stealing money. I was stealing toilet paper from work because I didn't want to spend my own money on it. And, you know, I had important drugs to buy and alcohol, for heaven's sake. And I worked in an office, and we were a financial office, and I was wildly enabled. I would have a Corona on my desk at 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm not kidding, and stand up and read my Wall Street Journal. And I had no idea what a woman in business looked like or how they behaved, so I had these very skewed ideas of, well, as long as you're standing up while you're reading, you're really doing something, and, you know, guys drink anytime they want, so I could have a Corona on my desk at 10. My boss was really the king of denial there for a while. So as I started to say, I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was living in La Jolla, and they said, there's a meeting at Scripps Hospital tomorrow night, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, thank you, bye. Had no idea where Scripps was, didn't ask, you know. And I drank for another year. When I finally got to, again, that feeling of, I want not to live. I don't know how to live. Well, that makes me want to weep. I don't get it. You know, people that seem to go to work 5 days straight, people that got to work every day on time and left at the right time, they seemed like a mystery to me. It seemed like, I don't know, people that got gas in their car and paid insurance and bought groceries and did the normal stuff seemed like a mystery. On the outside, too, I would look at women that had, like, matching belts and shoes. I thought, wow, how do you do that? That's great. anyway, everything just seemed too much, more than I could do. I didn't have the manual. I didn't know how to do it. I thought that drinking was my only relief, and of course, most of us find that eventually it's the problem. But it took a while to realize that. I got to another point of pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous again. And they said, there's a meeting tomorrow night on Girard Avenue, and I lived on Girard Avenue. Thank God. So I walked the 3 blocks, I think, I walked to the meeting. My sister was a nurse, and I kept imploring her to just take me like I was her patient. She was like, get away. I just was, standing still. I was like rocket fuel. And I was petrified, and I was overwhelmed. And I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. Am I crying already?
Oh,
thank you. why do I wear mascara? It's... At these moments, I think, why do I say yes to these things? I still haven't taken a deep breath. About 5 minutes to the close, I'm going to be roaring. Anyway, I went to this meeting, and people were, as many of us know, people were, talking, and they were bright, and their eyes shone, and they seemed to be actually communicating with one another, and they seemed happy. And it all seemed like I was, looking at something that I couldn't touch, like it was behind the glass in the zoo or something. And when the meeting started, they had, they asked for alcoholics, and people stood up. And much to my disgrace, my body stood up out of my chair and said, my name is Sharon, I'm an alcoholic. And the rest of me said, oh, for God's sake, please sit down, shut up. Oh, my God. You are such an embarrassment. Stop, Why do you do these things to me? And I sat there vibrating like a maniac and listened. I don't know what I heard in the meeting, but actually what I did hear, when they read chapter 5, there's an implied promise. Rarely have we seen a person fail. Of course, I thought I was the one that was going to fail, but there was, an implication that a lot of people seem to get this. Okay. And the word, people honestly follow our path. The word honesty hung in the room with, 10-foot-high letters. I was living a life that was dishonest to me. Dishonest to my boss, too, and anybody else that crossed my path. If I saw a woman with her purse open and knew that she had cocaine in it, I stole it because she was stupid enough to leave it there. Everything just changed around so that it was your fault and certainly not mine. I needed that. But the word honesty hung in the room, like, wow, maybe, this is a possibility. Because when I sat down, there was this tiny, tiny little glow in the center of me that said, I think this is important. I'm an alcoholic. And it seemed to cover a vast array of bad behavior, which was very helpful. You think you're a jerk and you're a this and you're a that and like I'm an alcoholic. Oh. Just like that. So by the end of the meeting, during which some guy stood up there and said that he had jumped off a bridge in sobriety. People laughed, clapped, thought, Mother of God. I didn't get it. But at the end of the meeting, I did not know that the secretary was joking. And he said, if you want this to be your home group, we have 1 membership left. Well, by God, it was going to be mine. So, I ran to the front of the room, I was going to knock down other people to get my spiritual membership. I just had to have it. So that was great. And this guy said, you know, talk to this woman and do this and do this and do this. And I said, oh. And I went home and I lit up a joint and thought, wow, me, clean and sober. And I had no idea what they were talking about. None. I took a shower. I didn't drink. I'm clean and sober. And eventually I got the, oh, we don't do drugs. Uh-huh. So my sobriety date is, although that day when I went in was August 8th, 1983, and I have not had a drink since that time, my sobriety date is actually October 31st, 1983. And this little special gold thing is XXV from my Monday morning women's group, and the likelihood of me getting 25 years without a drink was as likelihood of me flying to Mars tonight. There is nothing that came before that would indicate that I was going to listen to somebody, that I was going to follow directions. But as I've heard before said, I had the gift of desperation, and I would have done, I think, anything. Which, by the way, to go back to using, I realized I would do anything when I was drinking and using also. You know, whether it was stealing or sleeping with your husband or, you know, these other things that I wouldn't normally dream of doing. I realized that behind alcohol I could really do anything, and I was saved from doing the worst of it. So here, sobriety is starting, and I'm like a live wire sparking at each other. And it was Monday night, the first meeting that I went to, and by Thursday I went to a meeting and I said, I get how you stay sober in the meeting, but what do you do for the rest of the day? And people started telling me to, you know, meet with women and go to 6 meetings if I needed to and read the book and whatever. Put my hand out. And I did everything. I did everything. I do everything today. It has kept me sober for 25 years. It's the same stuff. I'm very grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous is the same program that I was taught 25 years ago. It hasn't become the Tuesday night version of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not the advanced version. Pay another grand and we'll give you the next information. It's Alcoholics Anonymous, right from the book. I learned to work the steps. I work the steps today. I work them with my sponsor. I sponsor women. As I said, I do service. I pray, meditate, both of them not as much as I'd like. I go to regular meetings where I'm known. I think it's important to have meetings where people know that you're there or you're not there. Sometimes I drop out of sight and people know when I'm missing. People were glad I was missing in the past. Good, maybe she won't come back. So I started my life. For some reason, it's harder when you get sober to start telling, like, what your life was about, or it is for me sometimes. My life in 12 minutes. I learned how to conduct myself as a woman. I became a woman in Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned to be a friend. I learned to be an employee. I learned eventually to be one of the employees. I wrote a fourth step 1 year, unfortunately well into my sobriety, about a resentment I had about an office manager. And what it came down to was he treated me like everyone else. Oh, shoot, that's embarrassing. But he, you know, oh, sponsors are wonderful. Yeah, he's treating you like everyone else. Okay, I guess I'll forgive him. You got to love fourth and fifth steps, because there have been many times that in the fourth step I wrote something, but it wasn't until the magic of the fifth step, talking with somebody else, having somebody else hear it, having somebody else's response, I see what I wrote. Hard to have missed that, but I did. And I learned to make the amends, every one of them, financial, emotional. Ones where I thought somebody was going to punch me. I had stolen from them. I had sworn I didn't steal from them. I got other people to swear I wouldn't steal from them. And I had stolen from them. So to go back years later and say, I'm so sorry. And I was greeted with a lot of grace. Someone I heard said, I was greeted with mercy and not justice, and that resonates. But one of the things I learned when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and started working the steps is that there wasn't a felony in my past. It was all misdemeanors, and I was like so filled with fear and blackness and the abuse as a child, and I was afraid to look down. I was afraid to go in. I was afraid to find out what was in there. And, you know, fourth step after fourth step, I became acquainted with myself, and, you know, eventually I got to join the human race like at ground zero. I stopped being, in the deepest hole, and stopped being, you know, if I weren't in the hole, then, you know, flying high. Started to just be able to be on the same ground as other people and really welcoming it. I remember the first time I sat in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and had this sense of equanimity. It's like, wow, these people are me. I am these people. Far out. these are my tribe. I found a pin that I had to buy. It said, separated from my group. Like, yeah, there's a group for me somewhere. And lo and behold, it turned out to be Alcoholics Anonymous. So I started living my life. I worked better. I became a success in my business. I met a man in Alcoholics Anonymous. We married. You know, we were world famous in our own minds and really dancing along. And we had a son in 1989 named Max, who's now 20. And maybe 2 days into this room, after having gone to treatment, been sober for about 6 months, gone out, he really has a habit of getting beat up when he goes out. It's very frightening. You know, as a mother, it's terrifying, and you love him. And as an addict, it's terrifying, and you just have so much compassion and empathy. I wasn't ready to get sober at 20, and it's hard. It's hard for a kid. Anyway, if he stayed sober today, he's got 2 years. I mean, 2 days, pardon me. 2 years. May God be merciful. I'll be good. And, all right, so we had Max, and 2 years later, I was pregnant with Jack. And I was sitting in my meeting on Wednesday night. I was due on Sunday, so I was full term. And the long and short of it is that the baby died for no understanding reason, no reason that people could understand. It wasn't the cord. It wasn't the this and the that. As the baby died, and I left this meeting, my regular meeting Wednesday night, and went by the hospital. I just thought, I better check. And then once I got to the hospital, it started unraveling. And, walking down this hallway at 1 o'clock in the morning, one of those hallways with no windows to the outside, and this nurse was walking behind me, and she said, "You're so brave." I felt a million miles from everywhere, and the long and the short is, I was in the hospital for 5 days. When I came out, it was my son Max's 2-year birthday. And the people of AA, they'd gone to my house, cleaned my house, got birthday presents, put a banner out front, "Welcome home, Sharon, happy birthday, Max." I just don't think that if I were still drinking, the people in the bar wouldn't have been alert enough to know that I was in dire circumstances. And, I mean, I go to my own behavior when I was drinking. I missed somebody's wedding one time, and I thought, I'll go to the next one, you know. I wasn't really capable of feeling what people were, you know, saying they were doing. Like, this is important to other people. So, you know, Jack died, and we lived through it, and it was devastating. And Alcoholics Anonymous saved us every step of the way. You know, I went back to my Monday night meeting because that's what I did on Monday night, and it was remarkable to have a format to follow, which was desperately important, and a forum in which I could share. And For some reason, I thought early on of women that get raped, and I thought they're as devastated as I am, but they don't have a place where they can just say, this happened. And I did. And I was saved by Alcoholics Anonymous again and again. So life went on, and shoot, we still got 20 years to go. All right, who's your favorite stank? No, I'm kidding. Okay, then we did have Sam, God love him, Sam, my little precious moonbeam, who's now 15, and who one day, like about 9 months ago, we're driving in the car, and he says to me, I was feeling sick, and he was at his dad's house, and Dad got me cough syrup with codeine, and I just knew, codeine's something, so I drank the cough syrup. I thought, oh, mother of heavens, and he just said it like, so I drank the cough syrup. I thought, this is advanced alcoholism right from the start. And while I was really thankful that he was open enough with me to share this really disturbing news, on the other hand, I thought, oh, no, you know. Well, it's not really surprising that he would have our disease. And he does. And he identified himself as an addict at a meeting a week ago. I nearly, you know, stood up and raved and applauded like a mad woman. That's my boy. I was calm. Anyway, so life went on, blah, blah, blah. We had two kids. We were married. You know, the stuff that made my life extraordinary was really regular stuff. You know, I worked. I was married. I had two kids. You know, it's not big rock and roll to most people, but for us, who used to crawl around on all fours and make animal noises, it's, you know, it's a big deal. Life went on, blah, blah, blah. One of the main things I'll tell you, because it affected my life so strongly, was when I was 15 years clean and sober, bipolar depression came and entered my life and hadn't been there before. And it was a good long time before I realized what in heaven's name it was. And I was tremendously ill and very diminished. And if you're concerned about someone talking about medication, please read the pamphlet, AA's in Medication. It's very clear. To paraphrase, says, you know, we have to watch out because we're people that would like to find a cure and a pill and so on. But when we have a condition for which a medical doctor prescribes something, we're to take that. And I wouldn't be standing up with my buttons buttoned on any day of the week if I didn't have medication in my system. I fought bipolar disorder so strongly that it was the reason that I first went into the hospital. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I was truly restored to sanity. You know, it was God's grace that got me back on the planet. Anyway, it has been such a big effect on my life. Sometimes it comes up in my thinking when I'm sharing it. Sometimes it doesn't. So there you go. And today, I'm quite normal. No. smooth and quiet most days of the week. No, actually, my goal coming here tonight was to keep my feet on the ground. I'm still that fourth child, you know, like, look, I'm a girl. Anyway, all right, so my marriage ended about 9 years ago, and pretty much because the bipolar just smashed everything. And I was pretty sure that was the end. I didn't want a date. Eventually I said to my son, who was like 19 at the time, I said, I think I'm ready for a date. This is after 8 years. He goes, no, you're not. And he thought about it a moment, and he said, okay, what do you want to do? I said, you're not taking me on a date. Like some Mercy movie trip, you know. No. And all this idea was formulating, something else over here was happening. So long and short is, your 10-minute speaker there, came looking for me on a Sunday night. We had dated when I was like 2 years in the program before I met the man formerly known as my husband. And Ken and I dated and, you know, it didn't work out and life went on. So he came to me on this Sunday night and said, Sharon, I've been waiting for you for 22 years. But, well, you have my attention. which really was one of the coolest things I've ever heard in my life. And when we were 60 days into dating, he gave me the most incredible 60-day token I've ever seen. and so, life goes on, surprisingly. You know, I love the line in the Promises. It's a new freedom and a new happiness. There truthfully was a time when a new freedom and a new happiness would have been moving in with a drug dealer. That would have been like my top of the line. And, you know, new freedom and new happiness today is Ken and my boys who are safe and my life. Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know that there was something in AA called the CORE program, C-O-R, Contact on Release. And I've been taking 2 meetings into Mercy Hospital, which is poetic because it was Mercy Hospital. That was my first hospital. I was in the locked wards. Now I bring a meeting to the locked ward and they let me out. And the other is the, I'll finish up in a moment. The other is the outpatient people. And, you know, they're making a transition from hospitals, institutions, and so on. So bringing a meeting to them helps to buffer where they were and where they're going to. And it's an honor to do it. I owe my life, certainly, to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe my well-being. I owe my ability to be a woman. I owe my children's happiness to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm grateful from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for letting me share.